بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. البخاري شريف. This one statement: إنما العلم بالتعلم والفقه بالتفقه. Knowledge is acquired under the tutorship of a teacher and gradually in installments. You learn one piece of information, then the thing digests, and then you apply that, and then you take something again, and again it digests, and so forth and so on until you complete the career. It's like food, you take and you digest it. And without digesting it, if you're just going to keep taking on ilm only, and there's no digestion, what's going to be the result? There'll be an indigestion, you'll be constipated. Sometimes you'll make a mockery of that ilm, and sometimes it may be that you may have just learned the word only and you don't know the application. And sometimes it will become just like an academic thing, that what is required is just learning. Applying is not really important, like how it is learned in a university. Just learn it as a course, and thereafter whether you practice it or you don't practice it, it's not of any essence, it's not a real important thing. So every aspect of deen will then become just of an academic importance, that you learnt it, now you know it. You learnt about Roza, for example, right? Fasting. And then in that, مَنْ كَانَ مِنْكُمْ مَرِيدًا أَوْ عَلَىٰ سَفَرٍ. You also learned that a person is on a journey, then he is given some concession. He doesn't fast at the time that he's on a journey, then he can cover it up some other days. So what's going to happen? So the moment Ramadan starts, he's going to start off his journey, so that he gets the full concession. So he doesn't have to fast the entire Ramadan. Then he'll look for an easy time, he can split the thing out. Whenever he wants to fast, he will fast. Right. Then if he doesn't know application, then it is a problem. Because he's just looking at the word and he doesn't understand application. So, مَنْ كَانَ مِنْكُمْ مَرِيدًا أَوْ عَلَىٰ سَفَرٍ. So he looks at the literal, at the surface meaning, that you are on a journey. When you're on a journey, then you can forego the fast. So what he will do is he will travel from Spingo Beach to Spingo Rail. So isn't that a journey? He traveled according to his car, he traveled to Spingo Rail, right? 3 kilometers away from here. And he says, I don't need to fast. And then, because he travels every day in his life, he travels, so he doesn't fast at all. So the fast, whole roza has all gone down, because he will say it's a Quranic concession, and the concession is for a traveler, and who can dispute that I'm not a traveler? See? So he will use the Quran or the Hadith for his comfort and his convenience. Not for what it is, but he will use it for his convenience. فَمَنْ كَانَ مِنْكُمْ مَرِيدًا أَوْ عَلَىٰ سَفَرٍ فَعِدَّةٌ مِنْ أَيَّامٍ أُخَرٍ. Then he will go on to namaz and say, well, I'm a traveler. So when I'm a traveler, then I'm eligible to this concession as well. So I don't have to read my sunnats. And number two, the four rakats will be two rakats. I can make it into two. So you see that whole knowledge will be just for his convenience. It won't be understood like how it's supposed to be understood. It won't be for taqwa, enhancing him in righteousness and taqwa, etc. Whereas, look at the response of the Sahaba-i-Kiram. إِذَا تُلِيَتْ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُ زَادَتْهُمْ إِمَانًا. When the Qur'an and the words of Allah Ta'ala are recited to them, then the hearts are gripped with fear. When they are gripped with fear, then what is their response? The response is totally different. They hear the words of Allah Ta'ala. So the Qur'an Sharif speaks about إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يَأْكُلُونَ أَمْوَالَ الْيَتَامَى ظُلْمًا إِنَّمَا يَأْكُلُونَ فِي بُطُونِهِمْ نَارًا. When they heard the verse that they mustn't eat the wealth of orphans, because you eat the wealth of orphans and you're filling fire into the belly. Now the Sahaba-i-Kiram took so much of precautions. Many of them had orphans to take care of. It's your brother's children, your sister's children, someone or the other you are taking care of. Meanwhile, you hear this verse of the Quran that eating the wealth of orphans is filling fire into the belly. Now, you got that orphan by your place, sometimes one orphan, sometimes it's two orphans. So they will make a total different preparation for themselves and a different preparation of meals for the orphan. Now, two preparations are going on in one home. Now they began to encounter difficulty because it's two different preparations. You can imagine now you have to make biryani. So one biryani for yourself and the household and another preparation for the orphan child. Two different preparations, right? Then it would be sometimes that the orphan child cannot finish it up. So if it can't be finished up, then you can't leave it for tomorrow, because by tomorrow it perishes. Right? It wasn't a zaman of refrigerators, etc. And even if it was a refrigerator, then curry kishri for the next till the next day, then it doesn't seem palatable. First day you ate it, finish, put it in the freezer and ate it again. Now it doesn't seem so exciting. Now again this parishani, again problems. So they encountered difficulties. When they heard the Quran, وَجِلَتْ قُلُوبُهُمْ, their response was that their hearts trembled with fear. They didn't look for loopholes and how can we work this out for us. No. They applied it not just to their convenience, but they applied it to their heart. No. Allah Pak wants us and we to get it and get it right as well. Then the whole verse of the Quran had to be revealed. قُلْ إِصْلَاحٌ لَهُمْ خَيْرٌ وَإِنْ تُخَالِطُوهُمْ فَإِخْوَانُكُمْ. When talking about orphans, then the more important thing in respect to the orphan is that you must look for their expediency. In other words, there could be several situations, right? What you could have done is either you had just appeased yourself in seeing that you are right in the numbers. Right? Like for example, you used up one of the orphan's goat, right? It was nice, fat, and a healthy goat. Used it up. So you appeased yourself in this way. Okay? It was one goat that of the orphans that was used. So you took one thin, frail goat from your flock and you put it into his flock. And you say his flock was 100, now it's restored to the origin. Now you're not looking at the size, at the texture, at the fitness. You know, you're not looking at all that. You're just looking at the number. Sometimes that can happen. Sometimes وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا وَلَا تَتَبَدَّلُوا الْخَبِيثَ بِالطَّيِّبِ وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا أَمْوَالَهُمْ إِلَىٰ أَمْوَالِكُمْ. Sometimes that what is deficient of yours, you are replacing your deficient with their good stuff. So the Quran Sharif then came to show the Sahaba Kiram that see, in respect to the orphans, then what is required of you. So what is required of you is to look at the expediency. And then the relaxation will come in. Okay, now you may join your food with their food because of the difficulty that you are encountering. The wastage in their food that's taking place. So وَإِن تُخَالِتُهُمْ فَإِخْوَانُكُمْ. But in all that, even though you are joining up your food with their food, but look at the expediency. So in your mind, whatever you're doing, when you're mixing it up, you're adding it up, so you're thinking, all right, today this child doesn't seem to be very, very healthy. It doesn't seem to be very nice. He's looking down, so he won't eat very well. Now, my normal budget was I would take one share of his and three shares of mine, right? So today I will take this quarter share of his and three share of mine. So this is how I will work out the whole budget for that day. I won't work it out like normal. Because what I'm looking at the expediency of this child. But if I'm not looking at expediency of the child, there's no one share of mine, one share of his and three share of mine. So I will just look at the number and I will do the calculations and I will deduct that amount accordingly. Now, if you were to look at expediency, then you look at it differently. وَإِن تُخَالِتُهُمْ فَإِخْوَانُكُمْ. Because brothers, they eat together. They are your brethren. And you will eat together. But Allah Pak says, وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ الْمُفْسِدَ مِنَ الْمُسْلِحِ. Allah Pak knows the person who means right, who means well, and that person whose mind is corrupt. He wants to score some type of an unfair advantage over that orphan. Right? So, he is extorting him, he is taking some undue advantage. So Allah Ta'ala says that I know about this. That you want to take an unfair advantage over this orphan, so be careful. Allahu ya'alamu al-mufsida min al-muslih. So you see that person who is going to learn the Quran Sharif with the true spirit, then he will apply it to his mind, he will apply it to his heart, he will apply it so firmly and so stringently, so strictly. And that person just wants to appease himself and he'll look for a loophole in anything. One saintly person, he is visiting his ailing friend. Whilst he's seated there at his bedside, that ailing friend he passes on. So immediately he extinguishes the lamp that was burning on his bedside. And then he goes into the bazaar, buys some oil, and he buys a lamp, and he lights it up. So someone asked him, "Bhai, you didn't need to take the pains to do all this. What is the need for doing all this?" So he says, "See, as long as he was alive, then we were using his wealth, and he had the right to use his wealth as long as he was alive. But now that he's no more, then this wealth doesn't belong to him any longer. Now this thing belongs to the estate. It doesn't belong to him now. In the estate there may be women. In the estate there may be minor children. Right? And their permission is not recognized. You don't recognize their permission. Small children, you can't take their stuff and say, "No, I asked you permission for it and I used it." They are minors. They don't have a mind of their own. They don't have the sense of responsibility. Really, they don't know what they are doing. When they don't know what they are doing, the Sharia says that, see, their permission and their consent is not recognized. The Sharia doesn't recognize it. You just want to leave their wealth. Right? And if you have to spend it, then you'll spend it only to their advantage, purely to their advantage. See, the Sharia has recognized this right of these children on account of them being minors. They will say, the Shariat will say, see, if it's a minor, then there can be three situations. Either you use up their wealth, so this haram, right? And number two is, you use it purely for their maslihat, for their convenience. Absolutely, only for their convenience. So this is permissible. Like, for example, using his wealth to buy his clothing. It's a minor, but it is his clothing that you're going to purchase with his wealth. So this is proper, this is permissible. You won't say that it is impermissible. Right? Then it's a third situation where there can be dair bain ad-darari wa nafa. There is a possibility of gain and loss. When there is a possibility of gain and loss, then you will use your discretion. Is the possibility of gain greater or the possibility of loss greater? Like, for example, you want to make an investment for the child. So you will think now, right? Okay, is the chances for this child benefiting in this investment greater or the chances of him losing? So you will use it to his advantage. So I showed you three conditions. In that there can be a fourth condition where you use something for your advantage, see, for your convenience, for your expediency. For example now, you know that this child is going to be with you for just one more year, right? And then he's going to move on. Right? He's from South Africa, you are living with this child in South Africa. And the next year, he's going to move on to, say, America, right? So, you say, no, I'm buying things for him. So what you need for him, you need a stove for him, you need a fridge for him. So you went and bought top of the art, you bought a nice stove and a nice fridge. 20,000 rand for one fridge and 15,000 rand for a stove. Nice. And now you appeasing yourself, knowing that this child is going to be just around for 1 year. So he used his fridge and all that, and his stove for that 1 year. Now after that year, he had to move on. So obviously, when he's going to move on, then this thing is going to be sold as second hand. Right? When it's sold as second hand, now he'll fetch about half the price of it. He's not going to fetch the full price. So you become the purchaser. And are you appeasing yourself? See, it was second hand stuff, I bought it now. Nothing haram I'm doing, see. So how your mind can play games with you. See, so in the old, this was the state of the people, okay, that Quran and that Hadith was applied to their mind and to the heart. They took it very seriously. They didn't just look for convenience. Okay. Now that is why they say now that to make taqleed and to follow the imams, right, in this day, for the reasons of proper smooth administration is compulsory. In essence, it may have not been compulsory, but without following an imam, then what can happen is there can be a total disaster in applying deen, right? Like how you have our university system, you have a school system, right? It's an administration, right? It's a system, it's an administration, they have all systems in place. You follow the system, then it works out right for you. But someone wants to do some type of studies, right? He wants to say, for example, engineering. And he doesn't attend the classes, not that university, he goes and studies his own books, doesn't come for lectures, doesn't come for classes, etc. And after he's learned, and so he says, you know, I am also an engineer and I can practice engineering. So they tell him, but you didn't go through the system. You have to go through the system. You know, the system is that there'll be 3 semesters, then you'll have to write so many papers, then your seniors will have to approve your competence, that you are a competent person or not, you know. Then you have to go through the whole board. The board will have to examine you. They will see your competence, all that, right? And then so many days you have to attend. Right? Then there will be so many years that it will take you to cover this whole course. Right? So after all this examination, testing, this punctuality, and when they have examined your competence, then they will give you a certificate that now you can go and practice engineering. So if that person turns around and he says, but you know, these engineers and this university, they have taken the monopoly over engineering and university. What will you say? They've taken a monopoly. They monopolize. See? Are you going to be impressed by what he says? It's all right, no mind. Go and practice engineering. Would you say that? For that matter, medicine, or whatever else, if he studied himself, he didn't go through a board, so many examiners, and so many protocols, he didn't go through all that. And straight away, he said, no, I studied myself, and I'm quite competent, I can do it myself. Now, will they allow him to go and do a heart operation, to do surgery, to give an ordinary injection? Will they allow him to do it? Now, if they don't allow him to do it, can he say, well, you know, you people are monopolizing education. So like you cannot say that you are monopolizing education, you cannot say that we are monopolizing deen. You will not say that they are monopolizing education. By the same token, you would say that they are not monopolizing deen. They're just confining it to the standards. The four imams are like standards, you see. Like how you have SABS approved, right? It's a standard. And why we say it's a standard? Because for approximately 1300 years, these standards were acceptable, were used, they were tried and proven, right? For 1400 years, 1300 years. And everybody saw that these standards were tried, they were proved, they worked out, and there was no flaw in this. By and large, there wasn't any flaw in this. If anybody's going to come out now and he will try and apply his own reasoning, then he's suspect. We will not say that he's totally flawed. Because there is a possibility, like that engineer or that heart specialist, that he's doing an operation based on his own personal study, and it's possible that he's going to get it right. But we don't want to take a chance. Because it can be fatal, it can cost his dear life. So we don't want to take a chance in that respect. So like here, you need the board, an examination, so many years. Then he had to see, go through his seniors. The seniors need to see and examine his level of competence. All that had to be done. Then they issued him a certificate. And with all that, they asked him, you know what? With all this what we are doing, but just as a matter of precaution, you have to come every year back to us and get points. You're not going to get and secure your points, then we'll strip you off. You'll not be able to practice. So why is all this precautionary measures taken? Just to preserve that knowledge, that science. So if that knowledge and that science was important, then the science and the knowledge of deen, is that not important? Like that was important, this was important. So in certain aspects, what is required is a control and administration. You got to control so it works well. It's like a control, it's a standard, it's a bureau of standards. So when you've got the standard, then it's working well. You can't say that person is a suspect. Now, how do you come up with the standard? The entire ummah had agreed upon this, had made consensus on this. When they checked it very well, the entire ummah was approved that this is a standard. Like how you say, now how do you know that this is a standard? Then you'll say, alright, the experts, they say that this is a standard. Don't you say that? Not any person. You talk of for example, steel, right? So they say this is SABS approved. So the experts in steel will say, alright, they must match this criteria for them to be matching the standard, right? So the same, the experts in this field, they say that this is the standard. So all the standards, all these experts in all different zamanas, all of them agreed that this is the bureau of standard, this is the criteria. When they agreed, then we took that as the standard. When he took that as a standard, if anybody is coming within this standard, then we recognize them. But if he's not coming within the standard, then we say he's a suspect. Now, just look at one simple case, right? Woman coming to masjid, right? One simple case. Now, on the one end, you've got a bureau of standards, you've got a control. But because you've got a bureau of standards and you've got a control, so the administration is smooth. You don't have any type of complications, right? Overall, by and large, the hadith is saying, "La tamna'u ima Allah masajid Allah." They don't prevent women from the masajid, right? Just as the hadith says, "Wabuyutuhunna khayrul lahun," but it is better for them that they do their namaz within their homes. So this carried on from the time of the Nabi sallallahu alaihi wasallam, passed on in the zaman of Abu Bakr radiallahu anhu. Then came the zamana of Umar radiallahu anhu, he put an end to it. Right? So you'll see in the Arab countries as well, besides the Haramain, you'll hardly find a masjid where women are allowed. Right? The Haramain is an exception, because the Haram in Makkah, Mukarramah, then you have to go and do your tawaf, be it a man or a woman, then you'll have to go for that reason. So they can't restrict it there, right? And Masjid al-Nabawi cannot be compared to any other masjid. Though every masjid is significant, but you can't compare it to the Masjid al-Nabawi. It's got certain exclusivity. It's exclusive in certain respects. One namaz is multiplied 50,000 times. So you can't compare any masjid to the masjid of Hazrat Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Right? Then, you look at the Masjid al-Nabawi from that zamana till now, do you see the level of precaution, the level of administration, and the level of parda and hijab? Do you see that? There's such levels of parda, hijab, etc. It'll be difficult for you to look at one woman. In spite of the crowds of the women that are coming into the masjid, but it's difficult. The way they cordoned off, you know, in the woman's time, that is just a woman's prayer area now, so they'll move everybody out. All the security will move them out, so it's only woman's namaz time and their area now. So everybody is removed. Right? And when they've gone out, then it opens out for men. So you don't have a chance to even see a woman, even if it's your own family, your sister or your mother, so you can't even see them in that time, in that period, in that you can't even see them. Right? So that level of precaution is being exercised up to this day, from the time of the Sahaba till now. This type of precaution is being exercised. Now, on the one end, the hadith says that don't stop them from coming to the masjid, right? Number two, by the same token, the hadith also says that the woman, when coming out of their homes, then وَلْيَخْرُجُنَ وَهُنَّ تَفِيلَاتٌ. They must come out of their homes if they need to, but in an untidily manner. That's the word. وَهُنَّ تَفِيلَاتٌ رَوَاهُ أَبُو دَاوُدٌ. So they must come out, but they must come out in an untidily manner. Not washed up, not dolled up, but they must come out in an untidily manner. They must come out. The hadith says also that they mustn't come out wearing any type of perfume. If a woman is coming out wearing a perfume, then she's good as a zaniya, as a fornicatress. Right? So these are the warnings of the hadith. Now, I ask you, in this age and time, does any person have that type of clout and authority to control women and ensure that they're coming out of their homes in an untidy manner, not wearing perfume? Have you got the strength? Ask yourself, have you got that? So when you don't have yourself, then you can't be selective in the application of the hadith. If you have the clout and the authority to do all that, it was a different thing. Now, you don't have the authority, you don't have the type of strength and clout to be able to manage those women. Then you say what? Hazrat Umar radiallahu anhu said, for administration purposes, this was the better thing. So, though there was a permission given, but now it's a matter of administration. You either allow it and then have a wholesale problem going on in every masjid. So a few months ago, there was a reported case in some masjid where they were allowing this in South Africa, that zina took place right in the precincts of the masjid, right? Because you don't have a control, right? According to the law, you can't restrict them. If they are holding hands in public and they're flirting around, right? You can't stop them. And even zina legally is not a criminal offense. So you can't even stop them from that. Now, how are you going to look after your masjid? Tell me. When zina is not a criminal offense, even in some Arab lands, look at Dubai and all that. In the airport itself, we thought of taking the airport hotel. You know, the wait was about 9 hours or so. So we thought, no, rather than sitting in the chairs there, we'd rather take the airport hotel. It's part of the same building. On the upper floor, go and book in there. So I opened the fridge to find wine there. Now it's a Muslim country and everything goes, everything works. So even in a Muslim, so-called Muslim country, you don't have a control. Right? When you don't have a control, then what will be the state of your masjid? So it was the foresight of Umar radiallahu anhu said, no, stop this thing here. If you don't have the control, you can't administer this well, then you will have problems on the ground. So let's control this. If we had that type of clout, and the women were so obedient, and they made that level of consideration for parda, for not dwelling out and coming out of their homes, and not wearing perfume when they're leaving out their homes, then we could have relaxed the law for them. But when you don't have the strength, and nor are they adhering to these standards, then you can't be selective. This side, all right, Bism said, but what about the other hadith which says that they should not leave in a tidily, presentable, neat, and attractive manner? What about that hadith? See? So you can't be selective in your approach. See? So this administration had come just to see that standards are maintained. So in essence, you will not say that a person cannot apply the hadith of his own mind, but really, he'll be a suspect. We don't know whether he'll stand up to the standards. He's matching up to the standards of the experts or not. We don't know about it. And it'll take us time. It'll take him time to see that he's in keeping with the standards of the experts. Whereas this four imams, they stand up to the standards of the experts. When I say stand up to the standards of the experts, how we prove it is for 1300 years the system ran. And there were great ulama in each zamana had approved of them. Like you talk about Ibn Hajar rahmatullah, expert in his zamana on the science of hadith. In spite of being such a great, great expert, but then too, he attributed himself to Imam Shafi rahmatullah, remained under Imam Shafi rahmatullah for his entire life. He said, no, I can't be an independent person. I can't do my things independently. I must then just follow the track and the trail of Imam Shafi rahmatullah alayhi. In spite of his expertise, greatness, the whole world uses his books. Such a great personality in the science of hadith. But I can't do without Imam Shafi rahmatullah alayhi. I will follow him. Right? If it was right, he would have definitely done this. Right? I am a genius on my own. I can write so many kitabs. I'm such an expert. Why can't I be an independent? I can't hold as independent status. My expertise, my talent, my competence. Why can't I do it? And I tell you, his books are such. Ibn Hajar rahmatullah, that every library has to require his books. I don't know any madrasa in the world who doesn't require his kitabs. But in that short period, he lived about 58 or something, and in that short life of his, he's prepared so many kitabs that an average student may end up reading his kitab in his whole lifetime. So many kitabs he's written. That's a miracle of his life. So many kitabs he's written. But if you were to cover, you read up all his books cover to cover, perhaps an average student will take his whole lifetime to finish all his kitabs. One kitab got about 30 volumes. 20 volumes, 30 volumes, right? So now, these people, in spite of the expertise, the talent, but yet they attribute themselves to these standards. Then even you look at the experts in hadith, for example, right? Experts in hadith, for example. So you look at a personality as Imam Tirmizi rahmatullah alayh, right? He's an expert. He's a student of Imam Bukhari rahmatullah alayh, right? He's an expert in his own way, and the whole world recognizes Imam Tirmizi rahmatullah alayh. For over 1200 years they recognize him. But then when it comes to applying jurisprudence, law, fiqh, etc., then he himself says, he declares, openly declares, that as far as the application and the understanding of hadith, then we'll have to refer to the fuqaha, to the imams. Fuqaha refer to the imams, right? Because whom a'alamu bi ma'ani al-hadith. Because they understand the meaning of the hadith better than the entire ummah. The strange thing of Imam Tirmidhi rahmatullah alayhi is, he'll quote the mazhabs, normally quote the four mazhabs, right? He'll quote them. But I don't think in his entire kitab, he quotes the mazhab of his own teacher, Imam Bukhari rahmatullah alayhi. He may speak about the description of a hadith, you know, as given by his teacher, Imam Bukhari rahmatullah alayhi. Say, this hadith perhaps is at that level of authenticity. He may speak of it. And he may quote his teacher, Sal to Imam Muhammad ibn Ismail and Hazal Hadith. I asked him about this. I inquired about it. So this is what my teacher had to say. But in the entire kitab, perhaps you will not find a single quotation where he says that this was the way of Imam Bukhari rahmatullah alayhi in respect to jurisprudence and fiqh. Why? Why was it? Such a great imam. The whole world is singing about him. But why doesn't he quote him in this respect? In spite of his expertise, in spite of his popularity, his greatness. So they knew Imam Bukhari rahmatullah alayhi, his field and his speciality was hadith. Right? This he may have known. We will not say that he didn't know about fiqh. But he wasn't at that level like the rest of the imams. See, the speciality was on this. And he wasn't at that level as the rest of the imams. So you give credit to where it belongs. To who it belongs, you give him the credit. Now you don't say now that because Imam Bukhari rahmatullah alayhi was an expert in hadith, therefore naturally he must be an expert in fiqh as well. Two different things altogether. They understood it. And he writes about it in his kitab as well. Right? But strangely today, see, because of the aggressive marketing strategy that exists in this day, right? So the way people talk, you know, do you follow the hadith of Nabi Sassam, or do you follow Nabi Sassam, or do you follow Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullahi? Do you follow the hadith, or you follow Imam Abu Hanifa? Who you follow? Now that's an aggressive marketing strategy. So by the same token, I may ask you, that do you follow the hadith or do you follow Imam Bukhari rahmatullahi? Who do you follow? Because on one topic, there may be five hadiths, right? Reported by Imam Bukhari, Tirmizi, Tabrani, Ibn Hibban, Ibn Majah. Five different people have reported one same hadith. But there is a variation in the meaning. One topic, but there's a variation. So I'll ask you, all right, whose hadith will you practice upon? And you'll tell me, Imam Bukhari's, right? So I asked you, what was the reason for preference? Because this is also hadith. Then you say, no, I have more confidence in the authenticity and the reliability of Imam Bukhari. So we also say the same, that we have more confidence in the reliability and authenticity of Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullahi. Here you relied on Imam Bukhari for the word. Here we relied on Imam Abu Hanifa for the meaning. You relied on what? The word. But on who? On a personality or on Nabi Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam? On a personality. So we also rely on Imam Abu Hanifa rahmatullahi. So now where do you come out with this? Do you follow Abu Hanifa or do you follow Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam? You see that aggressive marketing. It's an aggressive marketing. You don't want to recognize, but you want to make sweeping statements. See? So now this is all on account of deficient knowledge. Knowledge becomes deficient, then man's approach also goes all off beat. Because he doesn't understand what he's doing. Or he's willfully deceiving. He's got an approach that is deceptive. But for the person that's on the ground, he can't perceive it. Where's the deception? How is he deceiving me? He can't understand it. With time, then he understands, oh, this is... Like a person in medicine now. So you see, you have to follow the system, you have to go through all this. Even if you became a doctor in China, you'll have to write the local board examination before you can practice. You can't practice just like that. Because made in China is made in China. You'll have to follow the local board examination. So someone turns around and says, hey, but you know what? This board, local board examination, you know, you have to go through it. So what, have you taken the monopoly that only you can authorize? Are you the person that's giving shifa? Allah gives shifa. So why are you saying that I must go through this thing here? I can go straight to the books. You know, Allah gives shifa. So will you accept his argument? No one accepts the argument. You see this aggressive marketing. This is what is causing. It's causing not only a corruption and a commotion in the mind, but it is really causing a decay in the mind. The mind is decaying, corroding. You know? Corruption, confusion, and corrosion. So what is needed now is that people need to, again, learn to understand things in perspective. And this type of deceptive and aggressive marketing policies need to understand these things. So that the system that prevailed for so many years now, we don't just sideline that and try our own thing now. Everybody will try his own. What's going to happen just now in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, what will happen? Everybody will do his own thing. Namaz, he'll do his own thing. Roza, he'll do his own thing. Zakat, he'll do his own thing. But you know, even Bukhari Sharif is not a book for everybody. We need to have so much of understanding to be able to understand Bukhari Sharif. Because now Bukhari is writing small statements. One word sometime, one word, you have to have so much of knowledge to understand that one word. Not just the literal meaning, but who made these statements, under what circumstance they made that statement, that you know that. So you know Imam Bukhari Sahib Rahmatullahi, in what context he spoke about it. So we will only be able to appreciate it if we can contextualize. But you can't contextualize this thing here. And then you want to quote Imam Bukhari rahmatullahi, by Surah Fatiha parne ka tigana nahi. Can't read Surah Fatiha properly, and you're talking Imam Bukhari rahmatullahi. Get all your preliminary and basic information right, then quote that person. There's a mistake here also, and there's a mistake abroad as well. You'll find now someone is going for Hajj, so someone is giving Bukhari Sharif, take it. Muhsin Khan's translation of Bukhari Sharif. So what does that common person know? What does he know? How does he apply the Bukhari Sharif to his life? He'll find one hadith here, another hadith that side there. How is he going to make up his mind? What is he going to do? If he's giving preference, on what basis? Has he got that level of understanding? So this I say, not only a confusion, not only a corruption, but a corrosion. The whole mind is getting corroded, you see. So the simple thing is, if you know the thing very well, then you know it. But you don't know it, then don't take a chance. Don't pretend to know what you don't know. As the Quran Sharif says, "Ma ana minal mutakallifin." I don't pretend. If I know it, I know it very well. And if I don't know it, then I must, you know, the system is, "Fas'alu ahla dhikr." So the Quran has categorized people in two categories. One is that category that knows it very well. He knows it very well, right? So he is quite confident of the information that he's got, because he's learned it very well. Another person doesn't know it very well, then he can't take a chance. Then he must go to that person that knows it very well. Right? You want to do a heart operation for your child, you know it very well, I know something, I can take a chance, you know. I saw Dr. Venkat a couple of times. So, is that a license? Not a license. Not a license. You saw him a couple of times, not a license. So, either you know it very well, you're an expert, and the experts in that field have approved of your competence, right? Now you go and practice, right? It's all right. They will recognize you. But you don't have that level of expertise. They don't suddenly jump up. So, no, if he can do it, he's a man, I'm a man. Why can't I do it? Why, you've got some exclusivity in this science. So you can't use that type of arguments. That arguments are all flawed, and it's naive, and it is, like I say, you know, aggressive marketing styles that people have adopted that's creating this confusion. Allah Ta'ala grant us tawfiq.
Discuss some etiquette with regards to respecting one's elders with the parents, mashayikh or asatiza. A person should always have respect for his elders, and respect should not just be outward respect, but also from within, from a person's heart. He holds them with respect and he holds them with honor. And when addressing them, a person should not just take their name casually, but rather use a title of respect. If it's a person's parents or father, then he should say Abba. Or if it's a person's sheikh, then he should take that person's, address him with respect and using a title of respect. Then even when speaking of them in front of others, then they as well, a person should not just take the name and speak with regards to them, but also use their titles when speaking to others regarding his mashayikh and his elders. And then when a person sees them coming towards him, then he should not remain seated, but rather he should stand up out of respect to greet them or to make salam to them or to speak to them. And likewise, if one is approaching them and they are seated and they begin speaking to you, then don't remain standing and continue talking, but rather seat yourself and continue with the conversation. And then when talking, then don't raise your voice over their voice and don't enter into any type of argument or discussion that would lead to any problem. And if you require their assistance or need to speak to them, then from far don't shout out to them or speak to them, but go up to them and sit directly in front of them and speak to them. And then if you know that they require some khidmat, which is obvious that you see that they require some khidmat, then don't wait for them to ask you to do that act of khidmat or service, but rather you promptly, immediately go forward and express your desire to serve them and carry out that act of khidmat. And if they reprimand you or shout you for some reason, then even if you yourself may not be wrong, but then accept their reprimand and accept that the rebuke, for in this lies barakat and blessings. And when walking with them, then don't walk ahead of them, but rather walk a few steps behind them, and this is a mark of respect and adab for them. And if they request you to carry out some task or some errand, then immediately upon carrying it out, inform them so that they are not left under the doubt whether the errand has been fulfilled or not. And if the work is such that you know from past experience that it is not manageable, it is not something that you are just making up, but you know that definitely you won't be able to manage it, then politely express your inability to fulfill it. Otherwise, they would be thinking that this person is still going to carry out the task, whereas you will not be carrying it out. And if you notice them carry out something which outwardly seems to be a mistake, then don't be hasty in trying to rectify them, because many a times a person, his knowledge is deficient and he does not know that there may be a way out for the action that this elder has done. So a person should not be hasty in correcting them and rectifying them. And if a person lives near them, whether it is his parents, his asatiza, his mashayikh, then he should always keep a constant relationship by visiting them on a weekly basis or if possible on a daily basis. And if they live afar, then a person should keep contact whether by phone or whether in writing, And at intervals, a person should also visit them. And then some adab and etiquette with regards to contacting and phoning others. Then a person should, for example, with regards to the cell phone, a person should not set such a ringtone which has a musical tone on it, or likewise a ringtone which has tilawat of the Quran Majid, or some form of dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or the name of Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, or it has the adhan on it. For this, it has serious consequences and repercussions. But rather, a person should just set it as a normal ringtone, or if it is the alarm on the phone, then here as well, a person should just set it as a normal alarm. And then if you wish to phone someone and contact someone, then do so at a time when you know that you will not be inconveniencing him. And if you do not know whether it would be the time is suitable, then when phoning, then before starting of the conversation, first ask the person whether it is a suitable time to speak and discuss any matter with him, or whether you should phone at a later time. And then if you receive a call from a person whilst you are engaged in a conversation with someone else, then don't immediately answer the call, but because you are already speaking to someone else, and it is his right that you continue the discussion with him. So first take ijazat from the person that you are speaking to, that you are receiving a call, and whether you will be able to answer the call or not. And then with regards to bringing the phone to the masjid, then as far as possible, person should refrain from bringing the phone to the masjid. And if person is forced to bring it, then switch it off and then come into the masjid. For then it would disturb others who are engaged in salah or in dhikr or in any form of ibadat. Then also using the phone to take pictures of animate objects would be haram. That any form of any animate objects, whether a person draws it with his hand or whether a person takes it with his phone or a camera, it is totally haram and impermissible. And if a person phones, and on the other end is a woman, and it is something that is necessary for a person to discuss, then you should just be brief and to the point. A person should not unnecessarily lengthen the discussion and speak things that are not necessary. Then if a person receives a call and he is mistaken to be someone else, that a person picks up the phone and the person on the other end mistakes you to be your father and he starts discussing matters with you that you are not supposed to hear, then don't continue listening to that discussion, but rather immediately notify him that you have been mistaken to be someone else, so that this person does not discuss with you things that he does not want to speak to you. And then if you receive any message with regards to a funeral notice, etc., then one should not just broadcast it immediately, but rather verify the authenticity of that message, that whether it is true or not, and only after verifying it, then only should one go on broadcasting such messages.